With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Welcome back, here with Counterculture, here with Marie on Reality Check Radio. And as I promised last week, he's back fresh. Fresh from his media retox. Are you feeling a little green around the gills, Martin Gibson? How are you?
Hey, I'm good. I'm retoxed. Had a good, been getting all up to date with
what's going on.
Poor, beleaguered journalists are giving us that the New Zealand public isn't appreciating as much as they clearly should.
Oh, we'll dive into that. Now, you and I, we did have a catch up, as many saw on social media during the big off, but it is so good to be back. And it's good to be, because there's so much. You and I have been doing a lot of texting. There's lots of things that have sort of exercised us over the last month. So it's so nice to get back and talk about them. Yeah, and you're right. There has been the New Zealand media, there's been lots of twos and pros and ups and downs and backwards and forwards.
It has been a lot. I'd have to say about RCR coming back on air.
Dear.
In fact, in all the papers I've read and the TV I've watched, I don't think I've seen a single mention of it.
No, I think they're a little disappointed.
Well, maybe that. And it's sort of, you know, the other thing that I thought the other day was, it's amazing how there's no acknowledgement of how, by their own measures, RCR is such a good news story. You know, it's started and owned by women. Discussions between men and women that are very respectful and, you know, we treat each other as equals. We try not to talk over each other too much, but probably do it fairly equally. It seems that those things only matter if you're on a certain side of things.
Well, yes. And I have to admit, I loved that first day, your discussion with Alia and Paul and community. It was one of the things that Paul brought up was it was community, our RCR community. I think the engagement we have with them, the feedback we get from them, the love we get from them, and also too, they, you know, they don't always agree with everything that all of us talk about, but they still hang in there with us and they help support us and help direct us and guide us of what they want to hear and the things that are concerning them. That sort of interaction, I think, is something that other legacy media outlets can only dream about.
Well, I think, and I said this in that particular segment, one of the reasons that you're seeing a bit of an easing off of the vitriol that has been directed towards RCR was, I mean, firstly, the undeniable quality of the material. I think Paul was saying that he'd done something like 1,200 interviews in a year. And I mean, the volume of high quality journalism that's been produced for not very much money and zero money from the government. I mean, we always say about Cam's show, The Crunch, it's the best political journalism in New Zealand and it gets the least amount of government money, which is zero.
Mm.
Now, that's not a coincidence.
No. And the fact, too, that there are people now out there doing their jobs better than them. Like Cam had on The Crunch, Simon Anderson, and I've interviewed Simon a couple of times.
Yep.
Now, you know, Simon is a citizen journalist. It's been 15 months since he, you know, became the accident. He's an accidental journalist, really, and he's embraced it. He's realised that he was able to capture a moment in time. And since then, he's got a natural instinct for it. And Cam has often said, you know, if you want to be effective, you've just got to do it. It's
yeah.
not, you know, that instinct you don't learn.
There's that quote that I've made before of Godfather 2, you know, where Michael Corleone says to Hyman Roth that he saw one of the rebels blow himself up rather than when he was being arrested and kill a few soldiers. And he said, you know, the soldiers get paid to fight, but the rebels don't. And Hyman Roth says, well, what does that mean? And Michael Corleone says, it means they can win. And I often think about RCR when I think about that. You know, we, you know, this isn't a money-making venture for any of us. We're all, I mean, I think probably more famous than we want to be. it is that debt of gratitude that we owe all of those families that sent their children off to war, all those soldiers and nurses that went overseas to often suffer pointless death and injury. And we have so little to do in comparison. But by God, you know, it's high time more of us did more of it.
Yeah. As I said last week in the opening of the show, silence. You know, silence is a funny old thing. And there's been, you know, a lot of silence. And it's not necessarily the calling out that many of my friends, my woke friends in inverted commas, like to do, you know, the calling out of the injustices. It's not necessarily a calling out, but it's certainly asking questions and being allowed to ask questions.
Yeah.
And having a discussion. And actually, when information is presented, so CAS report and WPATH files would be a classic case in point in this, when work is actually done and presented at a national level, like it has been in the UK, that those discussions can be had in an open environment and forum. But even then, even though it has been touched upon a little in the legacy media, it's still now just nowhere near to the extent that it needs to be. And the COVID inquiry is the next one, you know, the COVID inquiries that have gone on in other places in the world. I mean, we're about to get ramped up here. The petition, the people's terms were delivered last week in Parliament, to Parliament, with Winston Peters and Tania Runkovic, and Alia and Claire were there. Actually, Alistair on our replays has done a really lovely summary of that. Yeah, it was really good. And, you know, there is, and then to top that off, Kate McNamara in, was it the Herald on Sunday or
it
the Weekend,
was Weekend Herald?
Weekend Herald did an opinion piece around the COVID inquiry. And this is how dreadful this is. I started reading it and I just assumed, oh, it's going to be one of those opinion pieces going on about how, you know, the inquiry is there and we don't need to change it. And why waste money redoing it? And everyone like us who, and supporters of New Zealand First who want an open inquiry and very full, open, clear terms, you know, really you just need to shut up now because, you know, you're getting too much airplay and just be thankful that there's an inquiry at all and let's get on with it.
It's all pressure release valve stuff, isn't it?
Exactly. That's what I was expecting.
Mm.
Well, more for me. So it's just as well I read it really, isn't it? Because yeah, she did not say that.
It was quite funny that her opinion piece didn't actually have who she was. I mean, I'd heard her name, but I had to look up and see that she was a senior journalist with the New Zealand Herald because, you know, it's got, in my view, it's like, well, who are you that your view, you know, what weight does your view carry? But yeah, no, it's largely centered around the untenable situation that Blakely's in objectively, that he, you know, was an advisor to Bloomfield and Michael Baker and all these other people who are just all over the TV all the time advocating these terrible lockdowns and people not seeing their dying parents, etc. And this guy's chairing the inquiry. So, yeah, as you say, it's great that there's an acknowledgement of that, although she does say it's difficult to swallow the contention that Blakely provided informal advice to New Zealand officials and policymakers when his peer review was cited, both in advice to Hipkins and additionally in an affidavit sworn the following month by Bloomfield and supplied to the Wellington High Court in a judicial review of the aspects of the MIQ system. So, and the government blocked this advice. They wouldn't show what the advice was on the grounds that it would compromise free and frank discussion between officials. It seems pointless to carry on this work, either narrowly focused or otherwise, if there are any questions over the impartiality of the inquiry chair. Good on you, Kate.
Mm. Well, I mean, look, it was obvious to anyone who had eyes even partially wide open that Blakely as chair was literally someone sitting there marking his own homework.
Yeah, I love that expression.
It was never going to work. What I find encouraging is particularly on the grounds that those terms, the people's terms have been submitted. It's gone to the petitions committee. And this has now come out. Now, in a just society where you have open discussion and no censorship and you're able to talk about things, this article shouldn't matter a jot. shouldn't matter to John at all, because it's very clear that there needs to, those commissioners need to be reset and the terms expanded.
However, justice must not only be done, but it must be seen to be done.
Exactly. However, the fact that McNamara has written this opinion piece that has gone out in the Weekend Herald is that Brooke Van Velden now, she will see that. And she will see that it is not just, again, in inverted commas, fringe commentators discussing this. There is a problem here. Something is very, very stinky in the state of Denmark, and it needs to change. And hopefully that this will be one of the little, again, little nudges that will say, hey, you know, this is a problem.
Recently coming out that, you know, the extent to which the government suppressed information coming out of Five Eyes about the possible lab leak origins of it, just carried on pushing the agenda. What they knew about the possible side effects from the vaccine, rather than saying to GPs, hey, look, you know, we're taking a bit of a risk here. These are the things that we've been informed are risks. So if you see any sign of say, myocarditis, for example, you know, really take it seriously to ensure the safety of New Zealanders. They didn't do that. They said, if you go against the podium of truth and saying that this is safe and effective, you could lose your practicing certificate. And then the following week, Dear Leader was saying, actually, you know, the person you should ask about this is your GP, because they know you best. Mm. This GP that she'd just threatened with the loss of their livelihood if they contradicted her. It is so pernicious. It's breathtaking.
Oh, look, when that happened, so, I mean, and of course, they'd even set the stage in April of 2020. Mm. They sent out a letter to all GPs, all medical practices, because we got one at ours, stating that if you did not agree with the COVID and pandemic measures as laid out by the Department of Health, that you were vocal about concerns in any space that was deemed inappropriate, i.e. you spoke out in media or on social media, that could potentially bring attention to you from the media, from the medical council. Now, at that point, Mr. Marie hadn't really given much thought to what was going on. I mean, like, he was consuming legacy media of the pandemic and all the rest of it. So he hadn't really thought much more of it. When that letter came out, that was a red flag and a huge bell for him to say, what? And it was at that point that he was like, oh, hold on a minute here. This stinks. Why are you sending this out? This is so unusual. And that's when, for him, he started to actually expand his scope of research, because why on earth, first time ever, why on earth would the Department of Health send out a letter like that? And then, of course, it just progressively got worse.
Well, then it snowballed, didn't it? And why on earth would the Department of Health hide data on health outcomes by vax status and refuse to release the information, even when they said at the outset that they were going to release it? And for me, you know, you can talk about all the evidence you want and all the numbers. I think it just goes over people's head. But things like that, if they don't give people pause for thought, then probably nothing will. And in our opening little interview with Alia and Paul and I, you know, one of the things that I said, which is a recent thing that's really sort of struck me clearly, is all of these people who say, oh, well, I don't believe in conspiracy theories, don't mean I've studied what is being suggested here. I think on the balance of probabilities, based on what I've read, it's not likely. What they mean is, I'm scared of even thinking about what would be if that were to be the case. And so rather than confront that possibility, I would rather mock people brave enough to bring it up as a way of making myself feel better, like putting my fingers in my ear and going, la, 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 because people saying that are kind of like the alarm going off when I want to sleep, and me mocking them is kind of like hitting the snooze button.
And then you throw in all the in-group, out-group dynamics, and you know, when you've got a government, and this is these are all the things that I'd love to see the inquiry look at, who then they have that playbook where they literally chastise and destroy anybody that speaks out against it. Did you see the video that RFK Jr. put out, I think was it last week, or the week before it might have been, for his campaign? And in there,
With Woody Harrelson.
That's the one, with Woody Harrelson. Brilliant. And about halfway through it, he speaks to a guy who is a former media and strategist, and he talks about the playbook. This media playbook and how they use this playbook to discredit and destroy opponents. And when you hear it so clearly and so succinctly, you see how that playbook was implemented here in New Zealand. And of course that it's going to be implemented here in New Zealand. She's got a degree in communications. And one of the one of the opinion pieces mentioned Vernon Small, in his opinion piece, says Government Comms 101 over several administrations suggests that a major pre-budget announcement, and this is he was talking in regards to the error in numbers with the Police Minister Mark Mitchell and Christopher Luxon announcing the extra beds in corrections, prison beds. A pre-budget announcement is worth almost $2 billion, made with a senior minister at the flagship post-cabinet press conference should be backed up with a basic fact sheet prepared by a department and tweaked politically in the minister's office, a list of frequently asked questions for the media and a separate one for ministers prepared after a black hat session to check all detail and road-tested answers to tricky and hostile questions would also be common. Finally, the minister, PM and staff could get their story straight just before they go to press conference. Now, he says across several administrations, and I'm thinking, no, this is probably across 6 years of dear leader's communications background.
Yeah, which he was donkey deep in as a minister, as an advisor to Parker, David Parker.
Exactly.
So he's not a disinterested party.
No. Yeah. I mean, I think he was one of the architects of all of this. Now, they have been discrediting, I mean, the whole creation of the disinformation project fits within that playbook. And well, they talk about that, you know, it's too discredit.
It fits, it has its origins in the CIA and other intelligence agencies that realize, hey, if we don't get a handle on the political thing, we're going to lose the war. So they became active and colluded with social media companies to stifle messages. And this happened particularly with COVID, but it also happened with mail-in ballots. I mean, again, Mike Benz. If you find anything, any interview with Mike Benz, and I know that two or three interviews with him, Paul's interviewed him, very, very knowledgeable guy. He's worked in that area. It's quite dizzying to hear the extent to which the messages are manipulated. But yeah, no, Vernon Small's, he sort of almost got the point, didn't he? He was sort of grudgingly admitting that a lot of what the government was doing was quite good, which was kind of a start. And he's sort of talking about shambolic press conferences might not have done any serious political damage to National, but as with the other main party pratfalls, it chips away at the public's confidence. He's not really kind of acknowledging that the media are deliberately and cynically chipping away at the public's confidence without any reason other than, as I said, Luxon maybe doesn't give a lot of those journalists the tingles the way they'd like.
No.
Or remind them of themselves.
Exactly. So, of course, for those who are wondering when this is, Sunday Star Times, it is, Vernon Small. I love the headline. This is the little things that count, but they count against you. He should say that's the small things that count. It would have been a much better headline. But anywho, he did. So he was just covering off all the little sparky things that have gone on in the last little bit. And, I mean, you've got the poor behaviour from yet another Green MP and Julianne Gentard, but the one that he did touch, and I'm glad he touched it because no one else has dared touch it, is the Te Tai Tokerau MP Marimeno Kapakingi's comment, no matter my words today, the government will not waver in its mission to exterminate Māori.
And being from the Te Tai Tokerau, she knows a bit about exterminating Māori historically. Those guys did it better than anyone else. I mean, there's something like 10 times more Māori killed in the musket wars, of which Te Tai Tokerau Māori were the main practitioners, initially anyway, than in the land wars.
Yes, but no, but see, actually, shame to Poe, actually, because he's very excited that Willie's going over to do the Oxford Union speech. Oh, my good Lord. Really? Anywho, the moot is in regards to the British Museum. British museums are not very British, is the moot. Willie is going across because, of course, there is a lot of mokomokai, which are the heads, the preserved heads that are held by the British Museum. And I think apparently they've got 7 of them. Now, if you were to talk, I reckon if you were to talk to most young people and you said, oh, you know, are you aware that these heads are over there? Yes. How do you think they got there? I bet you dollars to donuts, they would say, oh, they were stolen. Mm. They were stolen. Well,
stolen heads of chiefs.
Exactly. And this is Shane DePaul. From Captain Cook's first visit, Europeans were fascinated by the heads, which were traditionally being preserved to remember honoured ancestors and enemies. Such was the level of European demand to take mokomokai back home as curios, and such was the need of iwi to barter for muskets to defend themselves during the musket wars, that an awful trade in mokomokai of slaves grew up until it was banned by Māori and British leaders. Awful trade. Trade
in slaves. So people who were tattooed against their will and then killed and had their heads dried. Yeah. There was an interesting documentary which I'd urge everyone, particularly if you live in Tauranga or the Bay of Plenty, to watch, about the land wars on Sunday, and it was about the Tauranga Moana. But even though it had Mihirangi Forbes and her flat, affected, bloodless, kind of relentlessly ethno-nationalist kind of slant on things, it did have the odd kind of hint that in some ways Māori have been the author of their own misfortunes, which isn't to say they haven't suffered injustice. But, yeah, at one point it had the tribes here building a pa and then saying, come and fight us here. And they kind of effed around and found out. And I can understand why Māori are keen to get out of the system that we all find ourselves in. But the mistake that ethnic leaders like Te Pāti Māori, like Willie Jackson, make is pitting Māori against non-Māori, when really our common enemy have a unbroken chain back to the same people who tried to take land off Māori while our ancestors, well, your Pākehā ancestors anyway, were settled here just wanting peace, not really sort of needing thousands and thousands of hectares and getting along pretty good.
There is a lot of what do they call it now? Malinformation, which is an inconvenient truth, you know, like the trading of those heads. That whole, Gad Saad talks about this, the whole noble savage idea. Yeah. And you just, look, history is history. And there's good and bad on both sides. And it's just this whole rewriting and cleansing.
Yeah, well, the fact that the musket wars were completely obliterated from the history that's to be taught to school kids, and it's admirable that history is taught to school children, New Zealand history. But, yeah, the musket wars, as I said, which killed 10 times more Māori than the land wars, and considerably more New Zealanders than World War One and Two combined or something like that. I'd have to get that. It's a breathtaking slaughter, merciless. And you know, also in this documentary about the land wars, they said once British soldiers were taken from the field and these wars against uprisings were fought by Māori who were loyal to the crown, things got a whole lot worse. And Mihirangi Forbes described as the machinations of the crown to set Māori against Māori. But I think it's really worth soberly examining that Māori proverb, it's better to die like a hammerhead shark than an octopus. That idea that there's no honour in surrendering or being peaceful. You've got to fight, fight, fight. And so the Māori Party are... that's their constituency, and not only not walking back that assertion that the coalition government were trying to exterminate Māori, Rāwhiti Waititi, the co-leader, said, this is how we feel and we will not be told how to feel. So, yeah, it's about feelings. He said many of the policy changes of this government made them feel there were huge extermination processes and policies aimed at the very existence of Tangata Whenua in this country. So it was absolutely the right wording. Ngā Rewa Pāka acknowledged some might not approve of that kind of language, but she argued her party's supporters had similar beliefs and it was their job to speak on their behalf. This is the party that represents that come and fight us here, die like a hammerhead shark, not an octopus. It represents, and there was another instance where the British said, oh, well, we're not going to wait for these guys to build another fighting park because we've got our asses handed to us a little bit by some very clever earthworks they did. So we'll attack while they're building it. And they attacked it with quite a large force. And rather than surrender, they sort of charged them with shotguns and got, again, they effed around and found out. But one soldier, in the documentary, it recalled one soldier saying, hey, why didn't you surrender when you saw you were up against such a large superior force? And the Maori warrior said, we must die for the land. It's a bit like people saying, I'd die for my children. I say, well, would you live for them? And so there is that element. And, you know, as a kind of getting into the weeds a little bit, but it's that taking of agency away and that the fact that Maori aren't encouraged to look at their own shadow and maybe look at things that maybe aren't serving them well and understand that they can do that without a loss of mana. There's a lot of interesting stuff like that in the paper. There's another thing about the history of law dating back to the 1841, so soon after the treaty, we were trying to say, well, to what extent are Maori subject to the law? And there were some quite liberal and enlightened efforts to bring it about. And I think we really need to keep going down that road. And it had also, after the wars in Tauranga, a British periodical saying, it's hard to turn away from the fact that these wars have their origin in our avarice for our neighbours' lands. So there was self-examination even back then. It wasn't the uncompromising, unethical drive to rob Māori that it's presented as. There was an element of that, and that factor, those niches are still there now, robbing us all.
Well, of course, there's the whole debate around tikanga and the entrenchment of tikanga within law. And it's funny, I've got booked, Mā Tāmua Taitui is going to come back, and we want to talk about this a little bit more because I know both you and I have explored it. Because if you actually look at tikanga, I've had some people ask me, well, you know, I don't really understand it. And there's a lot of feels when it comes to tikanga. But yeah, if you actually look at the core of it, it is in a way Māori common law. Common law is one that is often forgotten about and overlooked, but there is still a very, very strong element in the basis of societies around common law. And so you can see why colonially that there could actually have been a lot of coexistence and peaceful coexistence between the British and Māori, because the British had a basis of common law from the Magna Carta, and then you have tikanga, and there were so many overlaps there. And I get really frustrated when you have these activists that only want to concentrate on those grievances. And again, we're not saying there weren't some grievances. I mean, they're not lily white, the Brits, for sure.
Oh, the colonialists. Well, I mean, you know, we've got Irish and Scottish ancestry. We effed around and found out.
Yes, exactly. However, there are also plenty of overlaps. And I just think it's really cheeky for someone, she's saying, oh, you know, they've been influenced by the colonizers to go against others there. Well, actually, no, Māori have been fighting against Māori. They were doing that for hundreds of years before the colonizers turned up. They didn't need any external influence.
yeah. I mean, there's some, I think Paul Moon wrote an article about the Waikato wars, you know, given that there's a film coming out. And it is, it's hard to read, you know, some of the things that were done during the Musket Wars. They were a brutality that goes far beyond the land wars. And the land wars, you know, there was that element of, and, you know, this documentary said, those who stopped resisting lost a lot less land. It's like, yeah, you know, we can't judge it by modern modern standards, although it's worth understanding and resisting this image of the British back then as monsters, because as that book review that I mentioned holds forth, there was a considerable effort and a considerable liberal mood within the British that they didn't want to do that. And also a lot of friendship with Māori. You know, there was a very, yeah, that often gets obliterated as well, but it's a seed crystal that we might form from where we're more than the sum of our parts rather than at each other's bloody throats.
Yeah, indeed. Hey, I want to move on to a piece that you drew my attention to, which actually wasn't in the weekend papers, but was in Monday's. And so I went out and grabbed it, and I'm glad I did. And it was on the huge report that had just been released by Nina Hood. And it's around neurodivergent students in our schools. And of course, you know, Erica Stanford is... They campaigned on making dramatic reforms in education. They've started to implement them. And I mean, it's a big job. It was the headline story in Monday's Herald. The scale of the problem is enormous. A report highlights challenges for neurodiverse students. Up to 100,000 neurodivergent children are being left behind by an education system that is not only woefully lacking, but in some cases doing long-term damage. It's a report that's been co-authored by the Hub founder, Dr. Nita Hood, and it estimates that two-thirds of neurodivergent students in ECE or school are not getting state-funded support, and about 15 to 20% of all students are estimated to be neurodivergent. Now, when my son was diagnosed and we were going through all of this, so that's 15 to 20%, it was said at that point it was one child, potentially one child per class of 30.
Mm.
So 1 in 30, so that number has, that's 20%. Well, that's 1 in 5, isn't it?
One of my children has dysgraphia, which means it's difficult for him to read. He's got slightly slow processing skills. He's very bright, but he's got a few neurological issues. And again, you know, you kind of think, well.
So having been a mum that has literally been on the back of the horse with the armour on, fighting the arcane war with this, it is so tough. So if you are a parent out there and you have got one of these kids and you read this and you were, I feel your eye rolling from here. So 15 years I have been in the schooling, not quite 15 years, what is he now? So it would be, oh, well, you know, yeah, ACA, yeah, from diagnosis. So 15 years.
It's worth saying he's turned into a fine young man.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And I believe, yeah, he's a wonderful young man. He is a good fella. And, you know, so 15 years we've been battling this. Funnily enough, we got good support in the ECE space. You know, that was really quite fantastic. And then the wheels started falling off with primary school. I've gone through this report, and I have to admit, Hood has done some really good work here.
Yeah.
And when she went through, and I'm just going to do a couple of things that she highlighted. The report draws on 2,400 survey responses from those who engaged in the sector, including teachers, parents, students, and support service. Respondents from all backgrounds overwhelmingly described the current education system as outdated and heading towards major crises, with many seeing the homeschooling as the only option. Includes dozens of testimonials that illustrate the system's shortcomings, including those without support that should have access to it, those with support but not nearly enough, schools and teachers already so stretched that they can't do more, educators who could do more but don't have the right resources, training or skills, special education need coordinators or SENCOs, and learning support coordinators aren't required to have any particular qualifications, resources aimed at the bottom of the cliff instead of the top, systematic issues leading to students being punished or excluded for not learning when they just haven't been given the right learning conditions. I can tell you right now that nothing has changed in 15 years. I was coming up against all of this 15 years ago.
Mm.
And she actually talks about the whole difficulty and all of these things I can completely agree with. For me, the most important in any person in any school was the SENCO. If you didn't have a good SENCO and you had a kid who was neurodivergent, special education coordinator, you were screwed. These battles that our parents are facing, and I don't know how Erica Stanford is going to fix this. There's nothing new here. You've got a greater weight of these children coming into the system because diagnostic criteria have been improved. So they are actually being identified more readily. And the reality of it is that we took the model of not abrogating that responsibility for our son's education and support to the state, because you just can't.
Do you reckon it's just that, I mean, you know, is it just that their diagnostics are better, or is it that there's more of them too?
Oh, no, both. It's a combination of both. There's definitely more of them, but also more of them are being diagnosed as well. And the diagnostic criteria changed when our son was six. If you can get AWS funding, or so many doors open up for you and your child to be able to get the education you need. Here's the nugget, because we tried for AWS funding twice. Here's the nugget. The nugget is if your child is bright, so you've actually gone to the HAB testing done, whether it be publicly or privately, and you've had their cognitive testing completed. If your child is bright, they don't get AWS funding. Doesn't matter how extensive their needs are. And my son's got five alphabet soup diagnoses for him, five. And I was told that I needed to get AWS funding, I needed to do all this thing, I had to have these diagnoses. When we first tried, when he was 3.5 going on 4, we had 3 at that point. Nope, not enough. We tried again at 6 when we had 5, including autism. And they were like, no, he's bright.
Yeah, that's that drive for equity. It's like, he's bright, so he's not getting... If you have a strength-based focus, it's like, well, you know, this kid is going to get wasted if we're trying to hammer his square peg into the round hole that is education. And they do that in health as well. Oh, you know, you may have declined a lot, but you're still kind of average. Mm. So you'll be fine.
So the biggest thing, as I said before, you can't abrogate the responsibility to the state. You've actually got to take on a lot of this yourself. So I know a lot of parents that the way they've chosen to do it is through homeschooling. We tried that for 6 months and it was a disaster. You've got to be the right sort of parent to give that a crack. And
schools could be a
absolutely
an option for really come into their own there, couldn't they?
Totally come into their own. Don't think that it's not just, I mean, we had the state school down the road was the primary school he went to. Then we went to intermediate. I actually hunted based on SENCOs. The intermediate school he went to was low decile, a real mixed bag. It certainly had problems of its own, but it had an incredible leadership team. It had a wonderful principal and an exceptional SENCO.
Right.
When you've got a kid like this, it's the relationship you have with the school. And it's a two-way street between the school and you. We made sure that, you know, we put the money into getting diagnoses. We put the money into testing where things were at. And you know what? Yeah, Hood covers this in this article that it's expensive. But you know what? You know what? There are plenty of things that people are spending money on. You know what? Maybe you don't upgrade your cell phone or you don't do what you have to do. You know, you actually put that money.
You don't get rooms.
Yeah, where that matters. And you have to make those financial sacrifices. But I do also worry that there are plenty of parents out there that don't have the time or understand the system, the tenacity, or just overwhelmed by it, because it is overwhelming.
That's always been my thought about parenthood generally. You know, my wife and I are in a committed relationship. We don't have drug and alcohol problems. We don't have legal problems. We don't have mental illness problems. We don't have gang connections. We don't have, a lot of those challenges. And it's still quite hard.
Exactly.
And you know, you do think, man, how would you get this done if you had, say, all of those challenges?
Oh, you just wouldn't. You just struggle. Mm-hmm. And I think, you hit the nail on the head there. I think this is where charter schools, there is actually an opportunity. And I think Elwyn Poole, I know Rodney has spoken to him several times. Yeah. You know, he's somebody in that space where, you know, these kids, those are the sorts of schools, I think, that will set these kids apart. And for us, we knew his IQ was solid, but we had to work on his EQ. I mean, when he was a little tacker, it was pretty ropey. There was a lot of work that had to be done. I mean, we skated the line several times for him being thrown out of a school because of his behaviour. And ironically, when we did get funding from the ministry, it was because of his poor behaviour, not because of his neurodiversity. And it was awful because those funding applications had to be filled out. I saw them. And you're having to paint your child in the worst possible light to get the most meagre amount of funding. It's demoralising. It just knocks my knickers that there are millions of dollars that go to advocacy groups, Inside Out, just to name one. If that money was spent on kids with neurodiversity, bearing in mind that anywhere between 20 to 30% of kids with rapid onset gender dysphoria fall within that neurodivergent camp, well, I would actually much rather, instead of, just knowing kids with neurodiversity, I can see why they fall down this trap. I'd much rather have them have that money spent in actually giving them the support so they can critically think and learn and potentially work through all of those issues that they might have. Because ultimately, that group there are the most susceptible to social contagion because they want to fit in more than anything else. They want to be part of a social network and a social fabric. And they see that gender ideology is their pathway for adulation and rainbow and glitter and love and all of these things, when ultimately it's just an absolute recipe for disaster. But if we go down that pathway, we'll be here today.
You know, if anyone hasn't listened to it, your interview last week with Josh Slocum, fantastic. It was so great to hear someone actually characterising it as evil, as Munchausen's by proxy. You know, these predominantly mothers, often with some personality disorders themselves, using the children to garner attention and hero status for themselves. And I noticed there's in the Sunday Star Times, there's a bathroom bill on New Zealand First Agenda with old
Tabby
Besley of the Inside Out, their managing director, saying New Zealand First wants to fine people who do not use public bathroom of their designated sex if a new members bill passes. You know, there's all been all the stuff with the bear lately where women saying they'd rather be in the woods with a bear than a man they didn't know. It's like, yeah, that's why I don't want men dressed as women going into bathrooms when my seven-year-old daughter's getting changed.
They've misquoted Winston Peters on this. As he said, men's, women's, unisex. Mm. I use the unisex toilet all the time because the unisex toilet is usually the disabled toilet.
Yeah, legroom.
It's a bigger loo. You got more room to spread out. I mean, if that's going to be Tabby's mountain that she wants to die on, great. But it just shows you, I mean, at least with New Zealand First, they campaigned on this. They're putting it forward, right? They're working on this to get this through. And I just can't see why, if you are somebody who is in the transgender community, and even when you, I've just finished reading Irreversible Damage by Abigail Schreier, and I'm now reading Trans by Helen Joyce, you know, light reading, people, you know, light reading in my house.
Tell me what you're dreaming about.
When you read these books and you hear the history and the flimsy,
fraudulent research of John Money.
Oh, yeah, and the rest.
Good old Victoria University.
Yeah, and the rest that goes on that have gone and created these ideologies. What it also discusses, and especially in the book Trans, is it also discusses the number of people from a fetish perspective that are in this. And then you've got the social contagion and all the rest of it. At the end of the day, with these toilets, unisex toilets are there. Are they going to have people going in, you know, wanting to check these things? No, probably not. But ultimately, it is, you have to admit, particularly in the fact that when you've got intact males entering female spaces, there is an issue there. I can't even remember which paper it was. There's been another case now of a rape in a women's prison by a biological man claiming to be a woman, and a pregnancy is now confirmed. You know, this is going on.
Mm.
This is going on. And it's just, I have to admit, I look at all of this and I'm like, oh, really, guys? Come on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that terrible torture and murder that was gang-related that took place where the poor girl's body was stuffed in a barrel. And you know, she was tortured and murdered by two women, right? One of them was a dude. Mm. And you know, that I think I just saw that as a tiny little sort of note in the court transcript. It really wasn't widely reported. So, you know, if there is that aspect, and again, you know, I take my kids to the pool, you know, I'm not happy with the idea that there are And you know, if a transgender person gets dressed in the male changing rooms, I don't think anyone's going to hassle them. I think people are pretty open-minded.
Hey, we did actually get a bit of feedback.
Ooh.
Ooh. Just
from what? We've been off air for a month.
Well, we have, but people missed you.
Oh.
That's nice, eh? Right, here we go. Look, this one's just come in from the lovely Liz. Hey, it's great to have you guys back. A question: in the trailer for Marie's show, there's a clip of Marty talking on a victim mentality quote from Zuby somebody. Oh, the lovely Zuby. Could you please give me an info and link to follow up on the Zuby person? As it sounds interesting. Any help appreciated. Many thanks, Irene. Well, firstly, Irene, Zuby is spelled Z-U-B-Y, and he has his own podcast. He's definitely found on YouTube. I'm pretty certain he's also on Rumble. So if you just Google in Zuby, Z-U-B-Y, and you will find him, and he's brilliant.
He's a voice of reason.
He is a voice of reason. He's very, very eloquent.
Tucker Carlson interviewed him at one point, I think, which was...
Yes, and he's done his podcast. He's talked to a lot of leading thinkers. He really is fantastic. So Z-U-B-Y is where you find the Zuby. This is... From our lovely Mike. We love Mike. Oh my God, Marie.
Mike from Foxton. How are you doing, Mike?
Yeah, we love Mike.
Nice to be back in your living room.
Yeah, it is so good to be back. Oh my God, Marie. Josh Slocum is brilliant. We concur, Mike. He's put his finger on the real history of all the different rights groups and the effect that they have on our society. He's a very clever man and has some very good ways of dealing with the problems that they've brought on us. Men being men and standing up in a situation, not worrying about how it looks to the rest of everyone around them, is so right. Josh has my vote any day for the way of dealing with this and bringing the problems to the public eye. You go, Josh, and you too, Marie, for this great interview. Mike from Foxton. Thanks, Mike. From Louise, can you advise on the book that you mentioned that has totality in its title? So that was in the interview. Ooh, which one was it? Oh, it was with the CAS panel, I think. But it's The Psychology of Totalitarianism by Matthias Desmet, I think, is the book that you're looking for. And the other book I also mentioned was The New Puritans by Andrew Doyle. Oh, here we go. Hi, Marie. I know you're busy. I found your interview with Josh Slocum very good. He mentioned men needed to speak up and fulfill their role. This talk explains God's design for men and women. Martin would be worth interviewing too. Cheers, Paul. And he's gone and sent me a really great clip to check out, which I've had a look at and agreed. Going to see if we can track him down. And there's been lots of, hi, Marie. Why in the hell does our Ministry of Health need to have stakeholders and how does that work? Well, interestingly enough, stakeholders, and it was in regards to, I think I said to Jan Rivers from GenSpect with the guidelines and that they've been looking in terms of gender ideology. In New Zealand, had they contacted them as a stakeholder? We're all stakeholders. Anybody that casts a vote or anybody it serves, we are all stakeholders in this. But the interesting thing is of course, there's a lot of cherry picking that goes on. It doesn't matter whether it's in education or health. The government will be very selective about who it gets information and feedback from, which is why things like the people's terms and these, when calls for feedback are actually asked for by the government, that we actually get them in there. Because as the recent Department of Internal Affairs rollback, which I'm going to talk about more on the Fourth Estate on Friday, you know, that's where this feedback makes a difference. So, yeah, those are who the stakeholders are. And it is, yeah, Josh was great. And you're right, Marty, it was good to talk to him. And there's still lots of things to talk about.
Hopefully we'll get a shorts clip out of that. But, yeah, he said, this is, you know, you're going to get some feedback from this, but, you know, people need to just start saying to women, no. And you know, I'm sort of reading a lot of articles in the paper and there's that sort of consistent denial of reality, whether it was old Darth Vance, you know, saying Labor should have closed the door and legislated so we couldn't mine, you know, or Claire Trevor saying winter is coming and so is the blame game. And, you know, it's just kind of snarky. First, they blamed Labor for banning oil and gas exploration. Then they tried to make it look as if they really had things in hand. Finally, they put up the longer-term solution. You know, it's kind of like the first step in us solving a problem is admitting you've got one.
Do you think that snarkiness is coming from the fact that the general population just doesn't listen to them anymore? Doesn't care?
No, I think it comes from the fact that 80%+ of New Zealand's reporters describe themselves as left or hard left. You know, that's a big part of the problem. And a lot of reporters are functionally innumerate. You know, that's another big part of it. And so, you know, you get Julianne Genta, like a lot of those outbursts, if you look at them, you know, thinking back to Josh Slocum, that's narcissistic rage.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, yes.
You know, that's totally. some lady said to her, hey, you've got the cycle and no one on it. It's wrecked my business. You know? What you're seeing is that narcissistic rage, and it's also a factor of, you know, putting people, you know, this obsession with young politicians. It blocks them doing the kind of maturing that you need because they have to say, hey, vote for me. Maybe they're selected as people who don't do the shadow work.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
You know? But yeah, I mean, you know, Audrey Young did a sort of article about Christopher Luxon, Man of the World. And again, it's just laden with this eye-rolling snark. But Luxon has Peter's back 100%. He does not deviate a millimetre from the view that there is not a jot of difference between the former Labor government's position and his government's position. I'm pretty sure he wouldn't have said that.
No.
Every opportunity to sort of present him as a buffoon, and you can understand his exasperation that boiled over, you know, when someone said, oh, can you say what sort of foods are woke? And he said, you know, with all the problems we've got in New Zealand, that's what you're asking me. And if you're looking for a signal that maybe TV1 have just started to feel the clippers, you know, that in combination with Winston's pre-election, I'm looking forward to being Minister of Broadcasting. I think they're going to keep getting a whacking. But there were a good couple of op-eds in the paper as well over the last week or so. One from Matthew Hooton wrote a good one. Labor needs a bolder leader than Hipkins. And he basically said that Luxon and Nicola Willis were basically sleepwalking in the same direction that wasn't decisive enough. And they were sort of about to deliver Grant Robertson's seventh budget, and you know he's at least willing to spell out the enormity of the situation we face. New Zealand is in its worst shape since the economic crisis of the early 1980s and the Great Depression of the early 1930s. And it has elected yet another government determined not to confront that reality, but to continue on its merry way of increasing spending while cutting taxes and borrowing ever more to bridge the difference. Richard Preble also wrote an article, The Coalition Government is All Action and No Message. This was basically, I think, what I've said before about Luxon. He's all features and no benefits. He's not spelling out his position. He's saying there is a problem with Christopher Luxon just issuing this press statement of aims, rebuilding the economy and easing the cost of living, restoring law and order, and delivering better public services. As the United States President George Bush Sr. famously put it, the aims lack that vision thing. So, yeah, that's there wasn't, I mean, Heather Duplessis-Allen, you know, I get, was another person who was at least willing to call out how boneheaded Comrade Cindy's little vanity project of banning natural gas
with energy,
to make a speech just so she could bask in the glory of her self-image as a bodacia of the environment.
And in the business page too, Fran O'Sullivan, she also talked about what Peter's views in terms of what he sees in a vision for New Zealand and like thinking like Singapore and Ireland. And what she says in there, which is, again, the quiet part out loud, is she talks about all the work in the places that Peter is going, which is, of course, in stark contrast to Nanaia Mahuta that kept your ass very, very firmly in the chair and at home.
Peters and Todd Barclay have just been slaying that portfolio.
Totally. And, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, Peters, this is his, what, third trip round as foreign minister?
His, the energy levels that he's shown. And, you know, he's given a couple of really good speeches. And that was another thing that that Richard Preble said, is that there have been virtually no speeches from Luxon or Willis, whereas...
Peters and Shane Jones have been absolutely tearing it up in the House.
Yeah.
I mean, Shane Jones on the whole energy crisis, what did he call them, Ponamu mannequins or Emu mannequins or something?
Yeah, he's really impressed me, Shane Jones, and I didn't think I'd be saying that.
Yeah, he's coming to his own. You know, we could keep going all day, my friend, but I'm
Well, this could be a two-hour show.
It could be a two-hour show.
We've built up some pressure.
We have. And remember, if you've got any comments whatsoever, 2057 is the text, and inbox@realitycheck.radio is the email. And, of course, Marty and I will be here all over again next week to go through all of this. There'll be much more. But again, Marty, thank you so much for your time this morning, and we'll do it again next week.
Thanks, Marie. Hey, and, you know, just so I don't forget, thanks to everyone who donated money to keep us on the air. You know, we're all in this together. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And, you know, keep, if you haven't signed up as a member yet, sign up. You know, what we're doing is a fraction of what we'd like to do. And I think we could get some real momentum, and we could make a difference to this country for all of our descendants. So let's keep going. I know we're all happy to be back.
And on that note, don't disappear. More here to come with Counterculture on Reality Check Radio.
Have a great week.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.